Hello, I'm the Duchess of Rutland. I'm so excited to be back with you for another season of Duchess, and this one will be extra special. I'm so grateful I've been able to travel around the country, see beautiful houses, and meet extraordinary people. But I've wanted to finally bring you inside and share all the magic we have here at our very own home, Beaver Castle. So in this six-part limited season, we are exploring my home, Grantham's Great Jewel. Bringing you every piece of its history, art, and culture, all of its past, its present, and the future. So I hope you enjoy this very special season. This is Duchess. Last week, I sat with David to discuss the history of Beaver Castle, and I met Harvey, where we shared a conversation about architecture. Have a listen to that episode if you haven't already. One of my favourite points of conversation throughout Duchess has been the role of women in private heritage. I've always felt this podcast is an opportunity to highlight important pieces of history that have often been overlooked. That's why I'm so excited to be sharing this episode with you today, where we will be speaking about women at Beaver Castle throughout history, and I will be opening up about what life is like being a duchess. Later in today's episode, I sit down with my daughter Violet to discuss what it's like to have this title, both its privilege and responsibility. But first, I'm meeting our archivist, Vicky Perry, to discuss the fascinating history of women at Beaver Castle. So Vicky, how long have you been here?
So I've been here almost 2 years now. I started in December 2020.
So one of the inspirations for my journey here at Beaver has been Elizabeth, the fifth Duchess. And before she married, she was obviously from Castle Howard. I think I know her, but you're going to now tell me so much more about her as a person, because you've got box upon box of letters, haven't you, from Elizabeth?
We've got a lot of records from her time. I think the early 1800s are really when the archive seems to be a lot bigger and there is a lot better survival rate. So we've got a lot of correspondence. As you said, she was born at Castle Howard and her father had been responsible for finishing the rebuilding of Castle Howard as she was growing up. And when she arrived at Beaver in 1799, as a young bride, she was a bit disappointed with what she saw. So the castle had been rebuilt after the Civil War. That was the third castle. And it was a bit dilapidated. And she wanted something a lot more modern and fashionable. And the good thing from her point of view and from our point of view is that her husband had a huge amount of respect for her. He was very keen for her to be involved in the estate and in the business. And we can see that from their letters that he really, really did value her opinions. So she ended up overseeing the whole entire rebuilding of the castle, as well as a lot of landscaping works, and she was involved in managing the estate. But they had 11 children as well, and she had a busy time juggling motherhood with the rebuilding of the castle and with her involvement in the estate. So when you think she spent 16 years building the castle, which is a remarkable achievement in itself, but she would have spent probably half that time being pregnant. So she had a huge job to juggle them all. So one of the things that we found in the archives, in 1804, we can see that she's in Brighton with her eldest daughter, Caroline, and she was ill with scarlet fever at the time. And it was believed that the sea air would do Caroline some good. And there is a lot of correspondence at that time going on between the fifth Duke and the fifth Duchess, because the building work had started in earnest and she was very, very involved in it all. So she was sending drawings to him that she'd done. He was writing back and asking her opinion. And you can see a lot of frustration in her letters that show that she felt like she was missing out a bit by not being here. There was a time when Wyatt, who was the architect, was supposed to be coming to visit and he didn't. And she was relieved that he didn't, because she didn't
want to be missing out on that. She wanted him to come when she was there. But her overriding need was to be with her daughter, who was ill, and she did die later that year in Brighton.
Because she was a devoted mum, wasn't she?
Oh, she definitely was. Yeah, you can really see that from the letters.
And unusual for her time, she breastfed all her babies.
She did, and there's a lot of correspondence with her mother. So her mother was Lady Carlisle, and she lived at Castle Howard. And when she first became pregnant, at the age of 18 or 19, when she first got married, she was determined to nurse the baby herself, which was Caroline, and her mother advised against it. There were a series of letters from her giving her lots of reasons, a good argument on why she shouldn't do it. And the main one was that it would take up too much of her time to do it properly and that she should be devoting that time to her husband. But I think we can probably see where Elizabeth got her strong character from, because she was equally strong-willed and said, no, I'm going to do this myself. And she definitely did nurse at least her first child. There are payments to wet nurses later on, but she did follow through. And I think her mother seems to have grudgingly accepted that it was a good thing to do and that she was succeeding with it.
But it was very unusual for that time.
It was. They would usually have had a wet nurse.
And just for our listeners, explain how that worked, Vicky.
Somebody would have come up to the castle to feed the baby in place of the mother. So it would have been somebody that had had a baby fairly recently, maybe even somebody who'd lost one themselves.
That's fascinating. So the fifth Duchess, Elizabeth, was also present during that great fire at Beaver. Could you tell us a bit about this and how Elizabeth responded?
The fire broke out here on the 26th of October, 1816, and it was just as Elizabeth's building project was nearing completion, so it must have been devastating for her. It destroyed a large part of the building, as well as a significant part of the art collection. The Duke and Duchess were actually in Cheveley at the time of the fire. Two maids discovered the fire early in the morning and they raised the alarm. The Duke came back, but I think the Duchess felt that she couldn't come back straight away because the thought of the destruction just broke her heart too much. But you do see from the letters that her overriding feeling is one of relief that her children were okay, because her children were here and the governess and the Duke's chaplain got them out.
Wonderful. In the archives, there is a really striking and rather moving eulogy to Elizabeth, the fifth Duchess, upon her death. Can you tell us a bit about it and perhaps read some of this to us?
Okay, so Elizabeth died at the relatively young age of 45, and her youngest child was just 5 at the time. So she only really just lived to see the completion of her work. And even 5 days before, she'd been inspecting some of the works in the drawing room. So the eulogy was published in the Gentleman's Magazine, which was the first general interest magazine to be published. And it recounts her life and achievements. It refers to her as the presiding genius of the rebuilding of the castle, and also her achievements in drawing and poetry and music and agriculture and cattle breeding. So she did a lot of different things. When she died, her husband wrote a similar eulogy that was sent around to the tenants of the estate, and there's a lot of reflections in that from this one. So he must have helped to write this one, I think, or it must have been based on his. So if I'm just going to quote some of it, it says, "Due to her elevated taste, Beaver Castle will long remain a magnificent monument. From its first commencement 25 years ago, in despite of momentary interruption from the calamitous fire in October 1816, until its recent completion, the lamented Duchess had been the presiding genius of the place and selected all the plans for its erection. Every rational suggestion which had for its object the decoration and the embellishment of this beautiful domain was adopted with eagerness and zealously carried into effect under her personal and immediate superintendence."
Wow. So she was some girl.
She was, yeah. She definitely was. It's quite
and
amazing.
And what does it feel like turning over the pages? Do you feel you know her quite well now?
I'm starting to get to know her a bit, yeah. There are a lot of her letters to be catalogued, so hopefully we'll get a bit of a chance to read through them in a lot more detail and find out a lot more about her. But I think what's amazing is she didn't just build Beaver Castle. She built Beaver Castle twice at the same time as she was having 11 children.
So the next one that really strikes me as being rather extraordinary woman is the eighth Duchess, Violet, who was a Lindsay before she became the Duchess. Now, in her own right, she was a character, I believe, wasn't she? And had rather a different temperament, most probably, to Elizabeth. Could you tell us a bit about her?
Okay, so the 8th Duchess came from an aristocratic family as well, and she was granddaughter of the 21st Earl of Crawford, who was a Scottish peer. And she married Henry Manners, as he was then. He later became the 8th Duke in 1882, and they had 5 children. But she was very different to Elizabeth. She doesn't seem to have been involved in the business side of things to the same extent. And there's evidence from her letters and her correspondence with her husband that he thought that she didn't understand the business and finances. And there are letters with him complaining about her overspending. So she was very different from Elizabeth in that respect. So her main interest was in art, and she was a talented artist, and that's what she had to juggle with motherhood.
But I find it fascinating going round this building, seeing that art, because it's here in evidence, starting with the chapel, isn't it?
Yes. So she was an artist. She was a very talented artist. She was encouraged by her family to draw. She was privately educated. But she also took up sculpture. And one of the reasons that she really continued with her sculpture was because of the death of her first son, Lord Haddon. And she created a sculpture of him as a way to help her cope with her grief after his death.
She shut herself away in the what is now the tapestry bedroom. And that's where the marble piece was that she would return to carve this extraordinary effigy. And the original is at Haddon Hall.
I think the original's at Haddon, and it's a copy here in the chapel, because he was Lord Haddon, so that's why.
Exactly. So the archives seem to suggest that Violet was drawn to art and sometimes found it very difficult to balance her artistic ambitions with her day-to-day life.
She was an extremely talented artist, and we have a lot of her drawings in the archives, as well as the ones that are on display around the castle. But she did find it difficult to juggle her passion with art with motherhood, and there are letters in the archives that show that she was even considering giving up drawing when the children were small. But she was encouraged not to, partly by her friend who was the artist George Watts. He seems to almost have been a mentor to her, and he encouraged her to draw pictures of her social circle. So she managed to weave her art and that nature of her work into her family and her social life. So we've got a painting in the archives that she did with her baby on her knee, and she drew her children a lot. So she managed to find a balance in the end between the two parts of her life.
Yes, and I remember finding it some time ago, a letter from Violet to her husband Henry on the 20th of March 1884. And she writes, "I draw a little every day, but find life a burden."
She did seem to find life quite hard. I suppose art is something that you need to be able to concentrate on, and it's probably quite difficult to do that with small children around. But she did try and draw.
It was her real release.
It was, yeah. It's how she coped with a lot of things in her life. And she took the children to art galleries and exhibitions, and she encouraged them with a lot of artistic hobbies themselves, like art and drawing and dancing and music and that
sort of
thing.
And she was a member of that infamous group of rather avant-garde artist called the Souls, wasn't she?
She was. So the Souls was an informal group of aristocrats who got together to share interests in art and politics and talking about that sort of thing. And I think they were called the Souls because somebody said to them, all you do is talk about your souls. So that's why they were called the Souls. And it included the Wyndhams and the Balfours and the Custs from Belton as well.
Fascinating. And there was another letter I remember when I was doing my first book, Beaver Castle, that I found so moving. She writes, "I am miserable with my drawing anxieties. I shall give up next year as I've lost my nerve for such things." And that was, again, to her poor dear husband, Henry, in about, I guess, about the 1890s. But then later on, she did maintain to carry on her painting and her drawing and her sculpture. And she said in one of her letters, "This has been done with little Robert on my knee."
Yes, and she says, "True, but such a splendid excuse for all its deficiencies," which she really didn't need to say. It's a beautiful little watercolour of a ship. They were obviously at the seaside, and you can imagine her sitting there with a baby on the knee, her knee in one hand and painting with the other hand.
And also I have to her to thank for all our bathrooms.
Yes, so she was very keen to make Bever more of a family home, to make it light and airy and have lots of storage areas for the children's toys. And she installed new bathrooms and electricity as well. So she really turned it into a family home. She allowed the children to have an input into the decoration of their own rooms. She bought carpets and curtains and wallpaper and that sort of thing. And one of the most important things that we're actually quite grateful to her for is that she developed two rooms for her son John to work in the archives. So the very basis of the work that we're doing today is in those two rooms that Violet set up for her son John.
Oh, that's amazing. But also, of course, she was responsible for luckily leaving us with that wonderful Harold Pito rose garden that we had.
She was involved in some renovations to the castle and the grounds as well. And we've got a book where she records all of the work that she had overseen during her time here. And one of the projects that she was involved in was the rose garden.
So just as you got to know Violet, are you drawn to her, Vicky?
Yes, I am. I think she's very different to Elizabeth. She's also very different to her husband. I think he was very sensible, conservative. He's referred to in one of the letters as Henry the Overworked. So he was very committed to the estate, and she was just very artistic, and she did what fulfilled her in life, but she also brought up her children, and you can see that she was very close to her children as well.
And they were very organized. That always amazes me about people who live in heritage. They're very realistic about death, aren't they? And they're also incredibly organized about what should happen at the time of death. And we've witnessed this extraordinary state funeral with Queen Elizabeth II. And I think we've all witnessed her attention to detail with everything that happened at her funeral. Just go through with us, if you would, what these two extraordinary ladies left for their children to carry out on the wish of when they died.
So both Elizabeth and Violet left instructions for their husbands on what they should do and how they should bring up their children if they were to die, which was probably quite a realistic thing to do in those days with so many women dying in childbirth. So in 1817, Elizabeth had just given birth to a son, and I think she'd been very poorly during the pregnancy and the birth. So she wrote a will, essentially, which is a letter to her husband saying that what she wants to happen to her children. So she's very keen to keep on some of the female staff that looked after the children. So, and one of the things that she says is, do not part with Miss Gooding, who was the governess. And she says she will be, I'm sure, a second mother to those four dear girls. She also gives instructions on where she wants to be buried. And she says in the middle of Blackberry Hill. So that is where the mausoleum was built afterwards. So Henry followed through with her wishes. And she says to him quite poignantly, I think, go on with Bever. It will be an amusement to you. And she did die 8 years later, and her youngest child was only 5 then, and he seems to have followed through with all of her wishes. Violet, similarly, wrote a letter to her husband in 1888, so near the beginning of her marriage. They had 4 children by then. And she says, dearest husband, if I die before you, here are little hints about our children for you. So she says that Marjorie, who is the eldest daughter, needs his care the most. And she's very keen for the children to learn how to dance and to draw. And she says the boys must learn music and drawing. She was very insistent on that. She also says that I know you will never let any of the children be frightened of you. And I feel so happy. Let the boys worship you and think you are their best friend all their lives. No fear.
That was very real then, the idea of losing your life in childbirth, which is now, luckily for us girls, a memory with all the support that we have with the medical development.
It was. I think it wasn't until after the Second World War that sort of medical care and the dangers of pregnancy were much reduced for women. So even during Violet's time, it was still a risk.
So when we speak about the significant women of Bever Castle, it isn't just reserved to members of the Manners family. Throughout time, the people who worked here not only became crucial members of staff, they in effect became part of the family. Can you tell us a little bit about some of these women and what you've learned? So I think that the two names that spring to mind are Susanna Gooding and Nanny Webb.
Susanna Gooding was governess to the children of the fifth Duke and Duchess, so she was here in the early 19th century, and she was one of a number of women employed to help the fifth Duchess take care of her children while she was busy building the castle. So she helped to look after the children when their mother died at quite a young age, and the Duchess obviously had a high opinion of her because she recommended to her husband that Miss Gooding should become a second mother to the children. And she stayed here for a long time. And we can even see her, when the children are all grown up in the 1851 census, staying here as a guest of the family rather than as an employee. And Nanny Webb, so she was here 100 years later. She arrived here in 1924 to look after the eighth Duke during his final illness. And she stayed on here for 50 years. So she looked after the eighth Duke when he was old, but she also looked after successive generations of children, including the current Duke. So we know about Susanna Gooding from the archives, and we know about Nanny Webb from the Duke. And the overriding impression that I get of both of them is that they've become part of the family and they're very close to the children that they're looking after.
Amazing. Well, Vicky, for me, it's been so enlightening to learn so much more about these women and the female staff and the history of this extraordinary building. So thank you for all your work, Vicky, that you're doing, and keep doing the great work, and we'll hand it over in a better state than that which you arrived with.
Thank you.
Your carriage awaits. The countdown to Christmas is on as the clock strikes 12 on the 18th of November 2022. Beaver Castle will be transformed into a breathtaking Cinderella-themed scene. Wander through the lavishly decorated spaces for an unforgettable family Christmas experience. For tickets, visit beavercastle.com. Now, coming up in the podcast, I will be handing the reins over to my wonderful daughter Violet, where we discuss what it is like being a duchess and the work that I do personally on this estate. So, Vi, how are you feeling?
Great. It's quite surreal to be sitting in front of the mic with you, and I'm very excited to be asking you lots of questions today, Mum.
Yeah, but this is obviously your idea, this whole podcast. What does it feel like to see it really alive and back here at your home?
I think it feels really special that we're doing a whole series on Beaver, dedicated to you, dedicated to Dad and the estate as a whole, because without it, obviously, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here, and I certainly wouldn't have come up with the idea of the podcast series.
What did you have in your mind's eye that the audience would get from these fireside chats?
I think you've got, you know, national publications in the mass media that tell a very different story about what it's like living in heritage. I think the Daily Mail would like our listeners to think, and our audiences to think, that, you know, you get up at sort of casually 11 a.m, have tea brought to you in bed. And I grew up with that being so far from the truth and so frustrated by the lack of honesty that was being reflected about these people and the families that run them in the press. So I was determined to get these women in front of the microphone and telling their own story and slightly take the rug from under the Daily Mail's feet and many other, you know, newspapers, I should add. And so as a result, as I said, I've watched you my whole life working all hours of the day, being a wife, bringing up five children, managing a team of 40, 50, God knows how many people. I knew that was the case for all these other estates across the country. You know, I think the biggest question that's facing heritage, be it National Trust or private heritage, is how do you reinterpret and reimagine yourselves to the 21st century audiences, listeners, world? And I think getting into the ears of people that are interested in heritage and history in a really authentic and real way, and bringing the women that run it day to day in front of the microphone, was just the most real and kind of tangible way of getting, you know, these places stories told, I think.
And so did it live up to your expectations by meeting these women with me and hearing their stories?
Yes. I mean, I think each of the women that's been on the podcast to date, I think we've had 32 or so, have been all completely different in character. But I think what unifies them all is their absolute determination to see heritage reimagined and see heritage into the next generation. And I think that's a huge bond that I witness being built between you all. And also, you know, I think the love, not only from the family that still inhabits these places, but the teams that run these places, and meeting the amazing people that work all of these estates and virtually think of it as their own home and treat it as their own home, and the passion and the love that they have for these estates that they work in, is just amazing to witness. So It certainly lived up to my expectations, and I hope it has done as well for our audiences. And it seems to have, I hope, just at least opened people's minds to what it really takes to run these places in the 21st century, and just, yeah, shine a light on all of the amazing work you all do. Right, Mum, are you ready to hand over the reins to me and the microphone to me so I can interview you?
I sure am, my darling.
Okay, great. So, although we're obviously really familiar with the word Duchess, and obviously we decided to call the podcast Duchess, people don't always know exactly what a Duchess is. So would you just tell our listeners, in your mind, what is a Duchess?
Well, you've got to remember, coming from a Welsh farming family, it was very difficult for me to understand what a duchess was. But the official word of a duchess is a member of nobility who ranks directly below the monarch. Mm-hmm. So that is an incredibly important and privileged position. And I think, hopefully, I'm becoming better at it all the time.
What historically were the roles and responsibilities of a duchess, Mum? When you look back at Elizabeth, Violet, you must have done this over the years. You know, you look back and reflect on Elizabeth's life comparatively to yours. What distinguishes the two in your mind?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, Dying, because actually aristocracy has, in this country, in order to survive, evolved and changed through time. Mm-hmm. And that's why most probably it is still existing to this day. So Elizabeth, I never forget my mother-in-law taking me into the linen room and opening this enormous trunk. And there are hundreds and hundreds of nighties, babies' nighties in this trunk. And I thought, oh my goodness, she doesn't expect me to have this many children, does she? I said, oh, that poor Duchess, all those children. And she said, no. What the Duchess would have done, Elizabeth, for example, mm-hmm. most probably would have been really busy with her team of workers and Thoroton and Gillow and all these people who are here on site in the mornings. Mm. And then in the afternoon, she most probably would have ridden, because she loved her riding, or taken the carriage to visit all the villages around, meeting her community and her tenants. Mm-hmm. And if they, you know, were struggling in some way, if they were having another baby, she'd deliver a nighty. So they very much were the social security of their mm-hmm. local community.
I doubt Elizabeth was sort of having to tackle the same questions that you've had to in your time about how do you keep the roof on? Because obviously times were so different then, and Beaver was, you know, in terms of an estate, it was probably double the size. So I think the distinction between even you Mummy, and Granny, you know, Granny Beaver, who previously was the Duchess, just like, I mean, worlds apart. So it's such an evolving role that you've made your own role, you know, in your own right.
Yes, but it's fascinating because every single person who's done this role here, and mm-hmm. I'm sure this would be the case for private heritage throughout the British Isles, the individual who's top of the pile for that moment in time brings their interpretation, as you say, and their expertise to that role, and the next one brings something else. And, you know, I look around this castle and see the wonderful work that Granny Beaver did on the restoration of the picture collection.
Yeah.
And I know nothing about paintings and pictures, and so I'm so grateful every time, and how she opened up the spring gardens and really ignited my interest in opening up all the gardens as we have now. So we all do our bit.
And then hand it on.
And that's it. You never feel it belongs to you. You're just a custodian.
Yeah.
In the 21st century, I think my role as a duchess has been here about getting the ship moving in the right direction. And it is like a ship. Mm. Many times it felt in the early days as if it was the Titanic, most probably, and going towards an iceberg. However, now we've got it straight and it's going in a straight line. The two things that I've done that hopefully I'll leave behind as a legacy for my position here at Beaver, and one would be setting up a countryside and cricket trust, and I'm patron of that, with Phil O'Brien. And that brings about 3,000 to 4,000 children from the local areas and cities such as Nottingham and Grantham and Lincoln mm-hmm. into the countryside, and teaches them about the countryside. And that's wonderful for me to keep that link between urban and rural. And then the second thing, Vi, which I hope will stand this building in good stead, is this charitable status that we've established on the public side of the castle, and working on amazing donors who are supporting us mm-hmm. to keep the very fabric of the conservation work going into the future. So that's the beginning of this next journey. So those two things, I hope, will help sustain the future of Beaver, keep it together, and make an easier job always for the next generation.
So, Mum, what does a typical day, Monday to Friday, look like? I know that you'll say you get up at 5, you go for a run. You probably beat everyone else to getting up. There's a kind of running joke that I used to have with Mum listeners that she, if I had said I was getting up at 6, she'd make sure she came down in the morning and said she was up at 5, even if she wasn't necessarily. So she's quite competitive, my mum. But what does a standard day in the life look like for you, Mummy?
Well, I love Earl Grey tea. So start the day with a cup of Earl Grey.
You like Lady Grey.
Or Lady Grey, yeah. So get up, trainers on. Mm-hmm. And go off for a run. That's by about 6:30.
And why has running been such a big part of your life?
I love connecting with the earth. And mm-hmm. I think I need to really ground myself every day. I can go quite off in my head and I can get so ungrounded. And I find running is a great way for me to recenter myself.
And so you get up at 6:30, go for a run, and then?
And then always try and look presentable. The first thing I want to do is put my face on. Nana Pete's taught me that, because I remember when I was busy having all you children when you were little, she'd look at me some mornings if I'd had no sleep and she'd say to me, just go upstairs and put your face on and then I'll make you an appointment to have your hair done. It became a sort of discipline.
Yeah.
And then of course you can sort of go on to whatever the platform of the day is. Generally on a Monday morning, if it was a Monday, I get the whole business mm-hmm. together and we go through what's going to happen the next 10 days. And everyone tells me what their priorities are, mm-hmm. how we can support each other, mm-hmm. and what's coming up.
Broadly speaking, your day, I mean, it's very hard to describe any given day of yours, Mum, because you are juggling anything in between the roof being fixed, for which there's lots of work going on like that at the moment, to collaborating with De Gournay and redesigning a new room, or writing your book, which we'll get to, you know, later on. And then also just the day-to-day running of like castle opening events, and you oversee all of it. So it's very hard to describe a day in your life because there's just so much variety.
Yeah. I mean, the last few years, I've absolutely adored doing up the Airbnb properties on the estate to create this Airbnb, it's a boutique mm-hmm. experience here at Beaver. And that's really fed my soul.
I mean, your dream job really is just doing up properties. You love doing up houses.
I love colour. I love fabric. That's my passion.
What do you treasure most about living here, Mum?
The views, whether I'm looking out or looking at it every day, seeing that unbelievable view. It's just so uplifting.
Yeah.
And imagining that view has changed so little over the last 250 years.
But the landscape around it has changed so much.
Yes, but there's hardly a pylon.
True.
There's no high rises.
True.
The landscape is exactly as Capability Brown designed it. Mm-hmm. And I put in the very last little bit of his plan that he did 250 years before.
Tell us a little bit, tell our listeners a little bit about that. Describe the project that you undertook with Alan Titchmarsh on your book.
So it was in 2003 that the archivist at the time knocked on the door and said, look what I found. And they'd always talked, Aunt Ursie and people had always talked about it. And they sort of wave a hand across at the landscape and say, that was all done by Brown, Capability Brown, you know, no evidence. There was no evidence. And then in front of us was this plan rolled up and tied with a ribbon, covered in brown paper. And they unrolled it very carefully. And it was, for me, at that moment, just too much. I said, oh, put it away. I can't look at it now. Just put it back where you found it. And we'll come to it one day.
Yeah. It's Brown's last landscape, isn't it?
Just about his last landscape. But for me, finding it and then putting in that last, I think it was 12 or 14 acres of woodland, exactly to the shape that Brown had intended it to encompass a landscape.
Yes.
That was my moment.
And that was in when? That was 2016?
That was 2013 was the terse centenary of Brown's birth. But it was 2013 or 14 the programme was made.
I remember with Alan Titchmarsh. And it is honestly amazing to see, because those trees that you planted in 2013 are really now starting to flower. And it's just amazing how it has changed the top of that field. And our listeners can go and see it, obviously. They can do the Capability Brown tour when they come to Beaver. And they do it in this beautiful little electric blue bus, which Mum commissioned. And it's such fun. So it's well worth going and having a look at what Mum's just described. And actually on that, Mum, I mean, I think it's interesting to ask, just because I know it's such a topic that I know Beaver's tackling, I know lots of other estates are tackling, but how does Beaver contribute to being as ecological in its like farming, in its planting of how many trees did you end up planting that year?
Well, I've saying the other day, nearly a million since I've been here.
Wow. So obviously you planted a million trees, amazing. You put in the wood chip burner a few years ago, which I can attest is sometimes a bit faulty, but that was a hugely important thing that you decided on how many years ago. Obviously the estate is abundant with dead trees that fall down at their own will, and so it means that we can feed our own energy supply into Beaver and to circular economy and for Beaver, which is obviously really important. And I think that's, again, like that's definitely going to have to be a part of Charles's future, obviously, when he inherits, and hopefully he'll find someone as active, energetic, passionate, smart, and loving and kind as you, Mum. But, you know, obviously, I think all those things relating to, you know, the farming of Beaver and how that might look in the future and have to change because of the 2028 regulations changing. And also, like, you know, frankly, will people want to be walking around a castle by 2040? Who knows? You know, these are all big, big, big questions that Charles is going to have to tackle with his wife of choice. What would be your advice to whoever that ends up being, and also to Charles in the future with when he takes over?
Well, a friend of mine who had an estate in Herefordshire, I remember chatting to him and saying, you know, it was all quite daunting at that stage. And his advice was, you know, just do what the simple well. Don't try and build an enormous great project. Take the steps day by day. That's exactly what Debo Devonshire said to me. I'm not going to say to Charles, do this, because it will unfold and develop. As long as he does the days well, the weeks will grow. For me personally, Vi, it was so overwhelming when we first moved in, and I had to really retrain my brain to say to myself, just get the castle right.
Are you the tortoise or are you the hare in life? Are you looking for the finish line to get there as quickly as possible? Or are you the tortoise and sort of think about things and take your time?
Well,
and
I definitely am the hare, but you have to be the tortoise. I push myself to such a level by the time I'd had the mental breakdown that I have had to relearn and put the jigsaw back together. It is the slow haul in heritage. You're never going to build Rome in a day.
Yeah.
You won't turn people's mentality and people's thinking round. It's quite frustrating that people get so set in their thinking and their ways. And so you have to have the mentality of a tortoise.
Yeah. And I can see that distinction in you from before you were, and then, you know, when you had your, as you call it, mental breakdown, I can see the distinction. And like, you just started doing, I mean, you still run at 1,000 miles per hour at everything you do. But I guess there's a bit more of a sense of, you know, you need to go for a run every day. Or, you know, you need to, you know, there are things that you do take time for yourself a little bit more actively than I guess you did when I was younger, I remember.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. Yeah.
And what was your memory of those young years, Vi?
I just remember a lot of fun, and you allowed us to have so much fun. You sort of encouraged us to have a lot of fun. And so, you know, I vividly remember having a little electric car and driving it around
the North Terrace
and inviting sort of children that were walking around the castle to come for a drive in my car, and I charged them £1 a drive. But I get to meet all these kids, and like, and we'd have such funny conversations. And again, like, you know, I spent years, probably up until relatively recently, which shows that I'm definitely still a bit of a child at heart at times, but around Halloween, I would often encourage my youngest brother Hugo and my other brother Charles to get under the bed in the king's rooms and sort of poke their fingers out underneath the bed when the tour groups are coming around, and you'd have all these people completely freaking out that they were seeing fingers coming out from under the bed. But I think for us, that, you know, we were doing that because I think we wanted to interact with the people that were walking around my home and our home. And I think, you know, it was hard to interpret how to interact with everyone wandering around when you're also a kid and you're seeing all these kids sort of running around, and you kind of, there was a big part of me that I think, you know, we wanted to sort of play and have fun. And thankfully, you know, you and Dad both, you especially, encouraged us to. So I remember a lot of that kind of thing. I also remember, like you, growing up at the farm and running the B&B and working at the B&B and meeting all these people from all over the world. I think similarly, like, one of the greatest things that you and Dad, but you especially, did for us as children is that I vividly remember coming into the library on any given night of the week, be it a, you know, a Monday night back from school, taking off the school uniform, putting on some clothes, and then our nanny or you would come downstairs and say, come on, come and meet everyone, come upstairs to the library. You've got to come and shake the hands of all the people that have just had a day shooting here and just keep asking them questions about themselves. And I remember thinking, why does she want us to come and meet all these random people? You know, I'm 7 or 12 at the time, but it was the most unbelievably helpful skill and gift that you could have given, I think, all of us children, was to just basically go and meet people, shake their hand, look them in the eye. And it didn't matter whether they were 60, 25, 40, but you always encouraged us to sort of basically just be brave and get in front of people and be willing to shake their hand, look them in the eye and ask them lots of questions about themselves. And I think that that ability to speak to everyone with the same level of respect and fascination, frankly, like making anyone feel special by asking them questions about themselves, is a lifelong skill that Beavers and growing up has given me. And I think it probably goes for all of us, to, you know, all my siblings as well.
And one of my memories, dying, was, again, going back to my Welsh roots and always being, you know, asked to sing for your supper, really, was after every meal, used to drive Dad mad, didn't it? You'd always have to get up and do a dance or sing a song.
Yeah, I did.
You always did the dance.
I definitely didn't sing. Eliza probably sang.
Eliza sang, but you were always dancing. Anyone who was here had to perform.
Exactly. It's, we still continue that tradition.
Absolutely.
So, Mum, alongside everything else that you're doing here at Beaver, you've obviously also just written an autobiography. What was that process like of sort of, you know, documenting your life from start to finish?
Oh, Vi, it's very emotional for me, you asking that question, because I honestly don't know why I wrote that book. I have no idea. Because the publisher rang me up and said, would you like to do it? And on one of those weak moments, again, when I don't engage too many brain cells, I said, yes, why not? So the process of writing it, dipping into memories, was so cathartic, so healing, and still quite raw in some areas, because you dip into memories that you think you put to bed and you've moved on, but they're still within you. And so I think now, it's a representative and it's the true story of my journey. Mm-hmm. And it's what I felt that we as women do in heritage. But I've had the blessing of my children to write it, and obviously David. And it feels as if it's not the end, but it would be nice to think it's really, and I know you hate me saying this, but it's like the beginning of another chapter. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the reasons why I felt I did it. I think I've got this ship going the right way now. Obviously, I'm not going anywhere. It's still work as usual. But I would hope, I'm quite intuitive and quite spiritual, as you know, but mm-hmm. I feel there's another story opening in my life.
That's really exciting. Yeah, and I know how emotional it was for you writing that book and how much came up for you that you, yeah, as you said, you thought you'd put to bed or you thought that you'd sort of made peace with, and actually there was so much processing that went on in writing that book. So it's a really heartfelt piece of work that you did with that.
Yeah.
Okay, Mum. And then final question. What would you say to your younger self about becoming, you know, the Duchess of Rutland?
Oh, gosh. Well done, Em. You did the best you could.
Well, you definitely did, Mummy. It's been such a pleasure being able to ask you lots of questions. So thank you so, so much.
Oh, thank you, darling.
I just, yeah, I'm always learning off you, and today I've learned so much, and I hope our listeners have as well. Such a pleasure, and let's hope that we can keep this series going, because it's such a joy to be sharing more about stories of the past and present with lots of people around the world. So thank you, Mummy, you're amazing.
Thank you, darling. It was your idea. This podcast has been a tremendous source of pride for me in so many ways, but I think something I'm most grateful for has been the opportunity to share conversations with so many inspiring women and spotlight the stories of those who came before us. Thank you, Vicky, and of course, my dear Violet, for sharing your time to talk to me today. In both of you, Beaver continues to have wonderful women guiding it. Next week, I will be meeting Tom Webster, our head gardener, to talk about the gorgeous gardens we have at the property. I will also be speaking with one of our wonderful tour guides, Olivia, who will take us through a number of ghosts and legends that we have at the castle. We will see you there. I just have a few final things to share with you. Please follow the podcast where you listen to them. So to keep up with the times, we've just started a TikTok account. And if you're interested in additional behind-the-scenes content, please follow at Duchess the Podcast. Also, I love to learn more about you and your story. Please write to me at our listener inbox. The email address you need is duchess@duchessthepodcast.com or visit our website. This show was produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From Beaver Castle, Violet Manners is the executive producer. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kasra Ferruzia is the editor and producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Selena Christofidis is the graphic designer. I've been your host, the Duchess of Rutland. And this has been Duchess.